book session number 24925, Reel 2.
So we were talking, obviously, about your interest in joining the Air Force.
Oh, yes. Well, the main reason was my brother joined the Air Force, and I always liked, I remember I was taken up for a flight before the war by a fellow called John Manford in about 1936 from Maylands. I remember being taken up by the exposure of about 3,000 feet. I was amazed that I could see the other side of Rottnest. And it always excited me, the idea of flying. And that's the reason I joined the Air Force.
What was the situation in relation to hierarchy seen by the average person? Army, Navy, Air Force?
I can't honestly think that there was any hierarchy. As far as I can gather, people either wanted to join the Air Force, the Army, or the Navy. They had various reasons. I know a lot of my friends tried to join the Air Force, and a few of them were colourblind, or they had one thing or another wrong with them. But and they joined, I think one of them joined the Navy as a writer. And but I think there's, I just like the idea of flying.
What were the reputation that airmen had, do you think?
Well, I think the airmen probably got a lot more publicity in the papers. Who was it? There was a Cobber. Someone or other. There's always photographs of an airman having shot down something or other, and they're always up there in the papers. I think the papers must have given the air a lot of press.
I get the impression that they were sort of seen as sort of the glamour boys of the Army.
Well, I think. Well, they all had various names. I remember anyone who was in the militia prior to the war were known as Chocos. They were in the chocolate soldiers. I think everyone's got a nickname for everyone else in a way.
What were the Air Force chaps called? I hear the word Blue Orchids.
Oh, Blue Orchids, yes. Well, I remember hearing the Blue Orchid. There was a song about something, the Blue Orchid. But to be quite honest, being in the Air Force and being called a Blue Orchid never worried me much. It didn't. I always felt that there was a sort of a touch of envy or jealousy in the in these people who called other people names. It helped them, I think.
In relation to the idea of the time coming, to be asked to go away and fight for king and country, how did that make you feel?
Well, I wasn't asked to go and fight for king and country. I volunteered. In the Air Force, we volunteered to go overseas and for service 12 months after the cessation of war. So we're all volunteers, and all the Army were volunteers, and all the Navy. So we weren't asked, we went.
What then of the idea of going away to kill the king and country?
It never entered the mind. I'd never even gave it a thought. But as I said, I remember when I was doing the training at Cunningham, I said to myself, now, why am I doing this? Why am I here? And what are my feelings? And I came to the conclusion that if I'd been born a German, I'd have done probably exactly the same thing for Germany. I had no ill feelings towards the Germans or the Japs. Someone once said that if you hate your enemy violently, it puts you off your aim. You can't kill him. There was really no feeling much.
I'm interested in the idea of joining up, obviously, to go away. In your case, the Empire Air Training Scheme, presumably. What was the process of you getting into the Air Force? And when was it that you joined the Air Force?
Well, the Empire Air Training Scheme was launched in... The idea was conceived in Canada at the Ottawa Convention. And they decided there that Canada would train so many pilots, navigators, air gunners, and the same with Australia and the same with England, to coordinate the effort of they didn't want to have too many pilots or too many air gunners. It had to be organised, and it was done through this Empire Air Training Scheme. And I think that, what was the question? How did I?
I was interested in the actual joining up.
Oh, the joining up.
Yeah, RWF.
Well, I was in the 16th Battalion, and I went along to see them to get my discharge, join the Air Force. And they laughed and said, "No, you've got no chance of joining the Air Force. You'll be a guard at Alice Springs." And it didn't fill me with great joy. So I eventually resorted to trickery, and I selected an afternoon. And I handed my rifle back. I brought all my kit into the drill hall there on the corner of William Street and that street down the bottom of the near the river. Anyhow, what?
William Street and Mount Bay Road?
No, it's
Wellington Street.
Further down towards the
river. St George's Terrace.
No, further down. Yeah. Anyhow. I brought it all along there, and I said to them, well, I've joined the Air Force, and I've come to hand all my stuff back. And I went around and shook everyone by the hand and said, you know, it's been marvellous being here, but I'm in the Air Force now, and here's my stuff. And my sporran, my kilt, and my rifle, and bayonet, and Glengarry, and the whole lock, stock, and barrel. And I thought, Liz, I need a bit of paper here. So as I was leaving, I said, well, you'd better give me a discharge to make sure that it's all in order. And they said, yes, we'll write one of those out. And I got that, went straight round and joined the Air Force. So that's the only reason I got into the Air Force.
The year? What year was that?
I managed to get in at... In June 1941, but I was trying for about a year prior to that. I joined in the 22nd of June 1941, which was my 19th birthday. So I've been trying to get in for a year.
In relation to the war and how it had been going, what was the general situation perceived from the Australian perspective?
That's very difficult to know. I know there's a lot of feeling that anti-war. I remember there was a reverend gentleman, Canon John Bell. He was always violently against war. He had been in the trenches in the 14-18 war. He'd received a military medal, which is quite an honour. But he was violently against war, and I had a lot to do with him when I was growing up. My father died when I was 14, and I was at 13, nearly 40, and he influenced me quite a bit, but not to the extent of not going to war.
What was your mother's view of the whole situation? Initially on hearing the announcement of war, and then on you joining the Air Force?
Well, of course, she wasn't... I don't think she was particularly pleased, but she realised that my brother was in the Air Force, and she knew I wanted to join the Air Force. So she accepted it. To my knowledge, she just she didn't say you can't do it or please don't do it. Or it was considered that I would do it, and that's it.
And when you mention on the 22nd of June 1941,
yeah,
you were to join the Air Force, the day that Germany launches Operation Barbarossa.
That's right. I remember they thought, well, now the Russians are going, the Russians are in the war, and it's going to make it that much harder for Germany. It's the day that Germany invaded Russia. Yes, I remember that quite well.
Up until that point, there had been operations in Africa and the situation in Greece, Crete.
Yeah.
Up until that point, the war hadn't been going amazingly for the Allies.
No.
By that stage.
No, at all. No. No, no, it hadn't. We realised that, and there's nothing. We heard about all the battles in the Middle East, and. Great friend of mine, Peter Salmon, he joined, he was one of the rats of Tobruk, and we used to hear various things about Peter, and yes, things didn't look too good, but I had a bit of a surge of confidence when the Russians came in. I thought there were a big crowd of people there, and there Germany will be attacking on two fronts, which I always thought not a good idea.
What sort of propaganda have you been subject to, do you think?
Well, of course, it's a pretty insidious thing, propaganda. You don't know when it's propaganda, or if it's good propaganda, you don't consider it propaganda. I suppose, I think it was a bit different to the 14-18 war, where they said the Germans killed and ate babies and all this sort of nonsense. I think that, to my knowledge, I wasn't influenced by propaganda, but then again, of course, I suppose no one thinks they are.
People talk of posters on the wall.
Oh, posters.
Your country needs you, that sort of thing.
No, I can't remember any of those posters.
What about newsreels, things like that on them?
Yes, they seem to drum up a bit of always showing soldiers, or airmen, or navy, back, you know, coming back home on leave, and all with a big cheerful smile. And I think there must have been a lot of propaganda there, but I didn't notice it.
What advice have you been given, do you think, by anyone in relation to going off and fighting? In your case, going off to fly.
No, I don't think I had any advice. I can't remember any of being given any advice.
Any of your uncles sit you down and say, hey, listen, mate?
No. No. All my uncles that I knew, the only uncle I ever knew, I met in about 1990, well after the war. They were all in my mother was one of 12, and all her family were in Victoria. And no, I didn't get any information from uncles or relatives. I don't think it was. It all seemed to be pretty straightforward. I didn't. You know, I wasn't. I wasn't pressured to do anything. Or
talk to us then about the training involved in becoming an airman.
Oh yes. Well, we arrived at. I can remember arriving at Pierce, and we're all sent into various groups. A flight and B flight and all the rest of it, I can't remember now, and various huts, and there are instructors, drill instructors and navigation instructors and instructors on Air Force law and I can't remember all the things, theory of flight, and it was all very interesting. I trained at Pierce and I was put back a course there because I was violently ill. I had a sickness, and I was put back from 16 course to 17 course. And it was rather sad for me to see all the 16 course fellows go on to Cunderton. And of course, at Pierce there was at Pierce you were either selected to be a pilot, a navigator, on air gunner, and a lot of people selected themselves to be navigators, but the majority thought they'd like to be pilots. I think.
Why do you think that?
Well, I think there must have been the thrill of piloting a plane, and it is a thrill. It is a once you've done it, you won't stop. You enjoy it.
And what then were the planes that you were learning to fly?
Well, at Pierce there's no planes, but at Cunderton we flew Tiger Moths. And
that sounds like real World War One stuff to me.
Oh, well, yes. They were marvellous little things, Tiger Moths. And we all talked to it in various ways. I can remember seeing a fella lying on his back on his bunk and closing his eyes and with his arms and legs practicing manoeuvres, what he'd do with each foot. And of course, absolutely, that's hopeless. You can't do that. You just do it without any. There were a lot of laughs. And we drank a lot of beer. And there's a lot of good fellowship. On the course that I started flying with 17 course. After the war in 1945, we had a reunion. We've been having a reunion once a year ever since then. So it was a pretty close-knit group. We all split up and went various ways, but we formed a bond there, which was has remained. And then after Cunderton,
describe to us your first experience of flying, piloting a plane.
Well, after I did 8 hours instruction, 8 hours and a few minutes instruction, and I think they used to count it by every 2 minutes. I forget now, but it was. They said I didn't expect the instructor to say. Go away, but he just got out of the plane and said, off you go. And it was a great thrill. You never forget. You never forget your first. It was thrilling. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's been with me ever since. And you still get the same sort of tweak of excitement every time you go into a plane or take off. Enjoyed. Came around and landed, and I was lucky enough to find that I didn't have any trouble learning to fly. I managed to get good marks and all the and everything. And then we went on to we were posted to Geraldton. I forget what day we were posted, but I know that the Japanese were coming into the war, They came in on, I think, the 8th of December, 41. And I remember when we were flying Ansons up there at Geraldton.
What was it like to fly an Anson?
Oh, they were gigantic planes compared to the Tiger Moth, because they're just a tiny little thing, an Anson, really. But we looked at them in awe, and we said to ourselves, will we ever be able to fly something so big? But we all did. But I can remember the... And we'd go out in pairs. My name, Anderson, so I always flew with Beck or Cameron, ABC. They just picked it from the top of the list. And a fellow called Robin Cameron and I used to fly a lot together because of this surname being close together. And we used to play jokes on one another, and we weren't allowed to low fly, but we all used the low flying, not the range so much as we'd fly around anywhere. And I can remember thinking that going out, and I said, I'm lost. I must have been fully 9 miles away from the drone. And I said, this sudden panic, feeling that I'm lost. So I went down and had a look at the name on the railway station. Felt much safer then. But they were told that you're never lost. You just need to say that you're in the Southern Hemisphere, you're in Australia, you're in Western Australia, and you narrow it down and down until you can pinpoint yourself. And
any accidents that you knew of in training?
Oh, I fortunately didn't have any accidents, but there were quite a few. When I was there, a fellow called Trigwell landed. He was with an instructor, and they were coming into land, and another Anson came in to land directly above them. And the top one landed on the bottom one just as they were coming into land. So the three of them hit the ground together. And I remember Trigwell saying that he could see this propeller whizzing around 6 inches in front of his nose, still going up. He was very lucky. There are lots of accidents. But you expect that sort of thing, I think.
The reputation of flight wasn't particularly a safe bet, as I understand. It was, and possibly later on you'd find out that the casualty rate would be high. Was that something
well,
you
no,
knew about?
No, we never considered the casualty rate at all. It was only when people got to England that they suddenly you thought you mightn't last the tour. It's been often said that people got to England and they said they posted to a squadron, and they said, how many trips do we have to do to finish this tour of operations? And someone said, oh, 30. And they thought, oh, that's not too bad. And they said, and how many have finished 30? I said, none. So it was pretty tricky. And that made him think a bit. It certainly would have made me think a bit. But of course, you never thought you were going to have any trouble. And luckily for me, I didn't have any trouble. But they were great days.
December 7th, yeah. Pearl Harbor. What was the feeling then when the Japanese had entered? What was your sense of...
Well, the feeling at Geraldton, I can remember quite well, where we're all stood down, as the expression was. You stood down, no more flying, and all the courses were mixed up. They didn't have an intake then. We all had to dig trenches. And the betting was even money, the Japs would land at Geraldton within 10 days. We had that. The feeling was there. Of course, nothing eventuated. And there are all sorts of funny stories about planes flying around that weren't in the Air Force, and there were could only be the Japanese. And it turned out that there were a few. Of course, they went all over Melbourne and Sydney. And there's still some thought at the moment that there could have been a Japanese plane over Geraldton. Although why they'd want to go to Geraldton, I don't know.
How were the Germans seen as soldiers in relation to the Japanese?
Well, we thought that the Germans were, I think they were considered to be better soldiers in the early part of the war. But then, of course, they realised that the Japanese were extremely tough and appeared to be quite happy to die for their king and country, and I've never met anyone really who's really prepared to die for his king and country. You always think that you'll get out of it. But I think the Japanese were considered to be rather brutal. But I always thought that they were pretty brutal and hard, but it's the discipline they had, which the soldiers received from their superiors, and they did exactly the same things to their prisoners of war. I don't think they went out of their way to be particularly nasty, but that's the way they were. You know, I think the Germans were considered to be very good, very good.
I get the impression that they were seen as at least playing the same sort of game. The same, at least they were playing cricket.
Yes, the Germans,
yeah.
Rather than the Japanese. Well, of course, really no one knew too much about the Japanese. It was a terrific shock, Singapore. I can remember I was up in Geraldton then. I think it was around about the 14th of February, I think. Might have been the 16th of February.
I have here 15th.
15th, around about. And I can remember being at a place called Satellite Field in Geraldton. You had the main aerodrome, then you had other little satellite airfields around, so there wouldn't be so much congestion on the one. And we were based at a place called Codgerina. And a four-engine, enormous four-engine plane came in, which was, that had come directly down from Singapore, and the pilot, an American, was lost, and he saw Codgerina. He was running out of fuel, and he landed there. And of course, it was such a very, very short strip that he couldn't get off again. And we had to guard we did a lot of guard duty after the Japanese came into the war. Everyone was took turns of being on guard. And we had to guard this, I forget the name of the aircraft. I think it was a fortress, they called it. And guns all over it, billy guns. And anyhow, they escaped from Singapore with a load of women and children and various men and landed there at... Yes, I can't remember much more about Geraldton. Oh, we used to do trips over the Abrolhos, searching for enemy shipping. I don't know what we'd have done if we'd seen any. But everyone felt that they had to do something. I suppose the commanders and the colonels felt that they had to do something. They didn't quite know what to do. Oh, yeah.